Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Fifth Third Bank, dedicated to the financial empowerment of the community by investing time, resources, and people in the Charlotte area and throughout the state. More at 53.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. We spent many hours in the past talking on this program about growing Charlotte's restaurant and bar scene, and more hours talking about the success of those attempts, as well as the rising quality and number of choices available to Charlotteans. Well, now we have to talk about a serious setback. The COVID-19 pandemic has hit that sector of our economy like a Thanksgiving turkey falling onto a pumpkin pie. If you can't quite picture that, it's a mess. Trust me, it's happened. The coronavirus shut down restaurants and bars completely. Restaurants have the option of offering takeout-only service, and many squeaked by doing so. Bars, though, remained closed. Then, restaurants were told they could open at 50% capacity, while bars remained closed. Then, just as we were about to lift the restriction on bars, Governor Cooper extended Phase 2 shutdown orders until September the 11th. So bars are still closed, even as restaurants are complying with an alcohol sales curfew that ends those sales at 11 p.m. This sector of our economy employs one in every nine people. In the good times, margins are thin, and some restaurants operate on a razor's edge. Well, now that razor is cutting to the bone. Some longtime favorites have decided not to reopen. For others, the future is tenuous. So this hour, we talk to several members of that industry. Greg Collier is a James Beard Award-nominated chef and a two-time award-nominated chef and owner of Leah and Louise. That's a Southern-inspired restaurant that opened in June. Timing. In Charlotte's Camp North End, and Greg and his wife Sabrina also own The Yoke. That's a breakfast spot in 7th Street Market in Uptown. Greg, thank you for joining us this morning. We appreciate it. You got to unmute yourself. You got to unmute yourself and say hi. You're still muted. Nope, you're still muted, Greg. Unmute.
Well, thank you for having us.
You're welcome. That took a while. Smooth. Paul Manley is owner of Sea Level in Uptown Charlotte, the Waterman Fish Bar in South End, and Ace Number 3. That's a burger spot in the Belmont neighborhood. He's also a partner in High Tide Hospitality, which runs those three restaurants. Thank you for joining us, Paul.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Bonnie Warford is owner of Earl's Grocery in Charlotte's Elizabeth neighborhood, but you may know her best for a restaurant just down the street, Carpe Diem. And after 30 years, she and her sister Tricia Madry closed that restaurant permanently, a victim to COVID-19. Bonnie, I'm so sorry to hear that, but welcome back.
Thanks. Good morning.
Good morning. And Jackie Deloach is owner of Hattie's Tap and Tavern in Charlotte's Plaza Midwood neighborhood. Like other bars, Hattie's has remained closed since March. But she joins us from the bar. I can see the artwork in the background. Jackie, good morning and welcome.
Morning and thank you.
Among Greg, Paul, and Bonnie, we have owners of restaurants in all areas of town and in different categories and price points. So I'm just curious as to which areas you're experiencing are the least affected or the hardest hit by all of this, from meat and three diners to fine tablecloth, white tablecloth dining. What types of restaurants seem to be most effective? Let me start with Greg. You have those two restaurants, a breakfast place and a dinner place.
So when it first happened, we just opened like literally the same day. And we had, you know, fine dining, small place and everything was like imposed plating. And we had a great first week. Like everybody came out, still orders to go and everything. But we found soon that everybody kind of wanted like comfort food. So we went to like the family style meals and went away from the small plates. And then it got to a point to where it seemed like everybody wanted lunch and we started offering lunch. Uptown Yoke is in Uptown and nobody's in Uptown right now. So Uptown Yoke is probably the hardest hit as far as our restaurants go. We've still been able to do a little bit at Leah and Louise. The interesting thing for us is we never had numbers because we never had a chance to open. So everything we see, every time we have customers come in, it's kind of like, wow, like we're amazed that people come in at all. So it's hard to judge which is which, but you know, I think we're in a really fortunate place with Lee and Luis because Camp North Ends, you know, you can get in Camp North Ends. So.
Right. So, Paul, you have three restaurants. One's uptown, one's in South End, and one's in the Belmont neighborhood. And they're all different styles, different price points. What's your experience been?
Yeah, I think along with what Chef Greg just talked about is that people gravitated towards comfort food, it seemed like, you know, pretty immediately. So the burger place, you know, really didn't skip much of beef. We have a small dining room. It's predominantly to go already. So it went down, you know, initially, but 2 to 3 weeks later, it was sort of back up where it was. Just everybody got their food to go. So the burger thing was really did well there. The Waterman, we closed for a long time. We'd had to adapt. People aren't typically don't gravitate towards seafood when it comes to to-go food. So when everybody was doing all the curbside and the big things like that, we had to adapt our menu and do things like that. So we made a lot of adjustments, but it was super slow at first in South End, just because we didn't have inside dining and we weren't known for big pans of lasagna or anything like that. And then uptown, it was just, you know, a ghost town. There was nobody there. So fast forward to today, the Belmont neighborhood is, you know, about where it's always been, just a lot of to-go food. South End organically has come back. And so we have that, the limited seating, but we also have a big outdoor patio and we have a rooftop bar. So that really helps with spreading people out. And so we've been able to get up to an acceptable sales level there. And then uptown, as Greg referred to, there's just really nothing happening. And so there's just, you know, nobody's working there. There's no events. And those two things predominantly is what we fed off of. And we are open for business and we're grinding it out in uptown right now, just doing everything we can to get people in there, but we're doing a fraction of what we used to do there.
Yeah. I'm going to come back and talk about uptown. Bonnie, for somebody who's been through all that you have been through in the years that you've been a restaurateur, you look pretty good because you've been through a lot. Carpe Diem has been around in this town since I can remember, and I remember going there when it was on South Tryon Street, and then you had to move out of that location because of the construction of a skyscraper, and you moved to the Elizabeth neighborhood after being out of business for a while. You opened that beautiful restaurant, and then the streetcar construction began. I'm sure that cut your business down to a trickle for a very long time. And now this pandemic hits and you've decided to finally throw in the towel. Why? What was it about this pandemic that after all those other struggles that you endured have told you the time is now to close?
There were several factors about it. I mean, certainly COVID was the driver, but we didn't intend to close. It was about a few months after we closed that, you know, we had cleaned out all the coolers and, you know, gone through all of that. Our chef left because he got scared and he didn't know what was going to happen and he got a solid job offer. We have several employees who worked for us for years, some of which have are immune compromised. So the reality was if we reopen, we have to hire a new chef. Half the staff would be new, and we only had about 7 months left on our lease. So the idea of shutting down just to reopen and start with a new staff just didn't make sense. So we decided, you know, this could go on for a year. We have no idea the ins and outs. We could have to shut down again. So we just kind of put it all together and decided we're not going to open just to close.
Yeah, you say that you felt like the potential losses due to reduced capacity and the uncertainty of what new restrictions might be put in place, like additional stay-at-home orders or whatever may be coming from the governor's office in the future, would exceed having to just close and pay rent. In other words, you're still paying rent on a restaurant that's not doing any business. So yes. Why does it make sense to close?
Well, for all the reasons I just said, I mean, having to restock all the inventory, hire everybody all over again, all of that. It's been 30 years also. And do we really want to start over in something that we just don't know in the future? Plus we don't have a patio. You know, that is something that a lot of restaurants who do have patios, they have, I think, have more opportunity because the fact is people do feel safer eating outside.
Sure. So, Jackie, when was your last day of business at Hattie's Tap and Tavern? When did you actually have to shut the doors?
We ended up closing actually on March 15th, so a little bit before the mandate that happened on the 16th that told us that we had to close on the 17th. We actually had our last day on the 15th.
So we are we're just shy by 2 days of 5 months of yes. having the doors closed. Have you had to pay rent since then?
Oh yeah, I've definitely have had to pay rent since we have been shut down, but we do what we can to make that happen. And I mean, we have a great team and a great staff here that has been helping us out.
And Bonnie talked about the need to empty out all the coolers because she's a restaurant, and if you're closed, you got food in those coolers. You have had your cooler emptied out, I think, twice, not voluntarily. You were broken into yeah. and they cleaned you out of all of your alcohol.
Yes. So the first time they broke into a shed out back and they took lawn equipment. But the second time they broke into our walk-in cooler and left maybe two cases of wine. So they cleared out pretty much everything. The only thing I had left was what was inside of the building. And luckily they weren't able to get inside.
So are you among the bar owners who don't understand or who don't agree with the distinction the government has made between bars and brew pubs? Because brew pubs, I understand, are allowed to open. Are you among those people who don't agree with that?
I apologize. I'm having a really hard time hearing. I think I'm okay. going to have to move where I am.
Well, let me repeat. Can you hear me now?
It's all my... Right. cooler okay. that I have inside here actually just popped on to okay. cool down. So I just can't hear anything. So I'm going to move over a little bit.
Okay. Well, I'll come back to you on that then.
Thank you.
Paul, Sea Level is your Uptown restaurant. And prior to the pandemic, Uptown was filled from, as we've talked about, from 8 a.m. till late into the night. There were games Uptown. There were plays going on. There were reasons to stay Uptown while the office towers shut down for business. And now... it looks like 1985 all over again when there was nobody there after 5 o'clock, but now there's nobody there before 5 o'clock. Prior to the pandemic, is that where most of your business came from? Did it come from people leaving the office? Did it come from people coming into the basketball games, coming into the plays at the Blumenthal?
Well, it's a combination of everything, really. Just, you know, we opened in 2016, and, you know, and there was already a well underway, a sort of a vibrancy that was happening in the restaurant scene, in Uptown. And so for us, it was a combination of people in the tower upstairs. We're in a 46 story tower. It's, you know, we're right across the street from the Blumenthal and Spectrum's right down the street. So there's a combination of all those kind of things happening. And then also, you know, the apartment buildings and sort of the residential aspect of growing of Uptown was there, but it wasn't a big predominant part of it. So, so we actually had our best quarter as a restaurant was the first quarter of this year. It was in January and February were just spectacularly busy and downtown was kind of the same. You know, a lot of people felt the same way. Some of our peers in Uptown were kind of saying the same thing, that they had a really good the year was off to was a really good start there.
So the residential parts of town are not supporting you to the degree you need to be supported. Is that essentially what's happening now? Because they're the only people left downtown.
Yeah, I think if you think proportionally of how many establishments are in Uptown and how many yeah. different people they fed and how many people they serviced, now you're just left with the residential, which right. is a really small part of that, of the population of Uptown. So they're there, they do come out and support, but you know, Fourth Ward, I don't know what the population of Fourth Ward is, and
small,
but it's a fraction of what works and plays Uptown.
So Greg is nodding in agreement there because he owns the Yoke in 7th Street Market. We'll come back and talk about that, Greg, with you after the break in just a moment. We got Paul Manley, the owner of Sea Level, Waterman Fish Bar, and Ace Number 3, along with Greg Collier of Leah and Louise in the Yoke, and Bonnie Warford and Jackie Deloach. We're coming right back. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the health of our restaurant and bar scene in Charlotte and the impact of the pandemic on it, along with Bonnie Warford, owner of Earl's Grocery and formerly Carpe Diem, Paul Manley, the owner of Sea Level Waterman Fish Bar and Ace Number 3 in the Belmont neighborhood. Greg Collier is with us, too. He's a two-time James Beard-nominated chef, owner of Leah and Louise in Camp North End and the Yoke at 7th Street Station, and Jackie DeLoach, owner of Hattie's Tap and Tavern. And Greg, you were nodding while Paul was talking a moment ago about the impact downtown of the lack of employees coming into town. But your Yoke, is in 7th Street Market, which, of course, is at the 7th Street Station Blue Line light rail stop. And you do have, you know, a bunch of young people who live downtown who may not want to have, maybe not want to cook breakfast. Is that helping at all in that location?
A couple things for us. The 7th Street Market is really, really, really heavy lunch. For us, that means late breakfast. For people working in office buildings, we usually get a hit at like 9:30 or 10 o'clock or something like that. Mm-hmm. The market hours have been shortened because, you know, it really doesn't make sense to be open as much as we would normally open. Yeah, there's nobody downtown. So people live downtown. There might be three or four different breakfast options downtown, and we get some. I don't want to be, crazy and say we don't get any, but the reality is all the people working downtown are usually the people who come in and get breakfast, and it's really slowed down. So yeah. I think trying to figure out if delivery makes sense or not is kind of the place we're in now. We're fortunate that 7th Street Market has worked with us on rent. I work with everybody on rent to kind of make sure that we're in a good place. But, yeah, it's definitely tough.
Okay. Jackie, I think Jackie's back with us now. So let me re-ask the question I asked a moment ago that you could not hear. Are you among the bar owners who do not understand or who do not agree with the governor's order or the government's order, the distinction that they have made between bars and brew pubs, which are allowed to open?
Well, it's not that I necessarily disagree. It's more of I'm fine with being closed as long as, you know, we're able to be also a part of the solution, where we're not able to really adapt to where we can show that we can, you know, make it work and follow all the rules and make sure that we can be there for the customer's safety. And so that's the hard part for me is, you know, we're not able to show that. We don't have the opportunity to be able to show that we can do it. And hopefully, you know, sometime soon we might be able to be a part of that solution. But yeah, as of now, we just have to sit back and watch.
You say you don't blame the governor for this shutdown, but you also say that you have been on the train to three more weeks for almost a half a year, as the governor keeps extending the shutdown for three more weeks. Actually, just extended it, I think, to five more weeks. That has got to be a drag on your finances and on your state of mind. So how are you personally?
It's tough. It's definitely difficult. And as you were saying in the beginning of this, you know, bars are still closed. And, you know, we get a glimpse of hope that we might be able to open, and then we still remain closed. And yes, it's difficult to hear. And, you know, I understand that this is a pandemic and that, you know, the everybody's safety is number one with this. But, you know, like I said before, I'm not necessarily angry. I just want to be able to have the opportunity to show something with my business.
Yeah. Chef Greg, you also plan to open Leah and Louise in Camp North End back in March, and you delayed that opening till June, but you did open the doors in June, and we're still in the middle of this pandemic. Why did you decide to fling open the doors in the middle of all of this?
I mean, first and foremost, it's because I'm a chef and we're ignorant and arrogant. So I just felt like, more than anything, I just felt like, I just felt like we were able to, you know, keep people safe, socially distance, and still have some seats. And again, we really never had that. We only got 50 seats inside and outside in the restaurant. So we never saw that 150 cover day where we were slam packed beginning to end. So from my perspective, it was good to see what we can do and how many people we can serve And try to get the food out there, and people get the whole experience, come in, listen to the music, have the cocktails, eat the food, because the reality, people really want to be out, and people really want to enjoy a good meal. They just want to feel safe with it.
Has the 11 o'clock alcohol curfew impacted you at all? I'm sorry to interrupt.
Go ahead. So honestly, we actually moved our hours back. We opened 5 to 9, and once the curfew hit, we saw an opportunity to kind of catch a little bit more of that late night crowd who was out from 11, you know, to 2, maybe get them to come out a little earlier and hang out with us if we, you know, opened an hour later or stayed open an hour later. So we went from 5 to 9 and 6 to 2. So, I mean, 6 to 10. So the curfew hasn't really affected us.
Okay. A couple of years ago, Bonnie Warford, you opened Earl's Grocery on Elizabeth Avenue. It's actually more than a grocery store because you have prepared meals and all kinds of goodies in there that people can come and pick up and go with. I don't believe, correct me if I'm wrong, that there are any restrictions on you at Earl's in terms of what you can and cannot do, but you say there have been challenges in the supply area. You say grocery suppliers have been constantly out of products. We've seen that. Anybody who goes to the grocery store has seen that. I'm kind of amazed that it's happening in the restaurant business, because you get first crack at everything. All the good tomatoes go to the grocery stores, and all the good meat cuts go to the restaurants. Why is this happening to your side of the equation?
Well, first of all, I want to say that one of the reasons we're not affected is because we moved all of our seating out and replaced it with grocery shelves. So, as far as, there's two supply chains. There's the food service supply chain, and then there's the grocery supply chain, and they are distinctly different. Mm-hmm. So we've got restaurant suppliers who don't have enough business, and we've got grocery suppliers who are so busy that they can barely keep up. So I've been placing these orders every week, and I probably order maybe 300 items trying to stock the store. And I'd say they're out of 80 items every week.
So almost a third.
And it's, I mean, the manufacturers are out of stock. It is not just that the warehouse is out of stock. The manufacturers can't keep up. Like Lysol products or Clorox products, those are kind of obvious ones. But just some basic things, like we don't get the eggs in that we ordered, or, I mean, it's just across the board, the number of products. So they are just having a real hard time keeping up with the demand right now.
It strikes me that the restaurant business, Paul and Greg, are you don't know what to order or how much of something to order. And if you're in the fish business, you don't want to order too much fish that just sits there and does nothing. What are you, given the changes that you're experiencing, how do you know how much to order? And are you experiencing, Paul, the supply chain problem that Bonnie was talking about?
Sure. I mean, it's rampant in our industry, right? For sure. It's just the supply lines are hampered. In the fresh fish business, you know, at sea level, we kind of specialize in this. We bring almost all of our seafood in from the Carolina coast or from farms in the Carolinas. So those supply lines were, kind of ready to go when we were ready to go. The fishermen out on the coast and out in South Carolina, North Carolina were ready for their line caught fish to be coming in. So those kind of things. We also have a partner oyster farm where our house oyster comes from. So that logistic was worked out pretty well. The tough one was really the beef at Ace Number 3. There was a all out beef war going on out there for a little while, which has sort of almost corrected itself, the fresh fish business, the way that we purchase seafood, we kind of have these kind of smaller supply lines, and we were able to work those out pretty quickly. Hmm.
Greg, what about your situation at both of your restaurants?
So the fortunate thing, and one thing that we haven't really touched on as restaurants, is the importance of local farming and you know, the local community here. I've been able to get most of my local products, like, you know, I call my friends at Two Pigs Farm or Off Grid and Color or any of Fresh List, and they have a lot of products because the local supply chain isn't broken. But like Paul was,
Fresh List has been doing an amazing job, sure, haven't they? I mean,
they've been killing it,
so
and they also have been doing a lot of, you know, person to person sales as well. So like Monty said, the grocery store part, the local piece of it has been really thriving. Ground beef though, I actually went to a local ground beef product because of the supply chain and how difficult it was to get the kind of ground blend that I was getting. Now we use a Brasstown beef in our burgers at Lee and Louise. So it was like, I think ground beef for us went up almost double. And I got emails and texts and they were saying, watch out, ground beef is going to go up. And I'm like, it's ground beef. It's literally the easiest thing to produce from a cow. And it went up doubling prices, but we change our menu a lot. So it's kind of, if I run low on a product, that I'm not getting local, I just change the menu. I'm not gonna say customers love that. It's a lack of consistency there, just because if you come one week and you get the beef, whatever, and then you come back the next week and that beef's not on there, it's like, well, change the menu. So that's the supply chain thing, and me just want to be crazy a little bit.
So, Paul, you have this restaurant in South End, which is coming back, and it's full of residents, and it's not just an office park. It's full of people who live there. And Greg, you have a restaurant in Camp North End, which is a new, emerging, hip area, and you are also a two-time James Beard Award nominee. Is that helping you, being in that hip area and being a nominee? Does that help you drive traffic to your new restaurant?
I hope what helps us is the quality of the food and the service in the restaurant. I would like to think that the James Beard nominations helped. Camp North End does a really, really good job of how they market the placemaking that they're doing there. Rachel Sutherland is our PR, and she does a great job of kind of getting us out there and getting the messaging out there. So I think all those things kind of help us and put us in a good position to thrive as much as we are. I think like we're at like 70% of our projections, which during the pandemic is amazing. And I also think like I said earlier, people really want to get out of the house and they really want to try new things. I think our restaurant is different from what you see at a lot of places in Charlotte. So I think all those things put us at a good place. So, we don't do it for the awards. We don't do it for the recognition. We don't do it for the nominations. But when they do come, they do lend a little bit of credence to who we are as restaurant owners.
So Bonnie and Paul and Greg, you all have restaurants, and Bonnie had Carpe Diem for 30 years. Kirby emails an interesting question, because one of you mentioned that you didn't know if, I think it was you, Greg, mentioned that you didn't know if breakfast delivery was something that would work for you at the Yolk. And Kirby emails, how much of a cut do third parties like Uber Eats and Postmates take from restaurants? He's been trying to support restaurants as much as possible with takeout orders, but he worries that when he uses those services, you are losing a big cut of the money he's trying to give you. Is it better to just call the restaurants directly and talk to a real person to place an order, or is it okay to use these services? Paul, I'll start with you.
Well, that's a real moving target. That industry is a very fluid one, and has a lot of it changes constantly. So there's a lot of competition. There's been a lot of piracy for sure. People, restaurant owners have given up way too much. It's a slim margin business, and to give somebody 30% just for taking the food from your door to somebody else's. So we've kind of stayed away from the partnering with third party deliveries. They ultimately, if they have a customer that wants to order from you anyways, then they're going to get it to them.
Let me also ask you a question about that, because I did this exactly one time through one of these apps, because I went online to the restaurant's page and noticed what the entrees cost after I placed the order. And this delivery service is not only charging me for the delivery, they had inflated the entree prices as well. Are you telling me that they do both those things and then charge the restaurant 30% on top?
Yeah. I mean, some of them do. Yeah. Now
so they're making more money than
industry as a whole. Oh, absolutely. They, in that transaction, they are way better off than we are. I mean, we built the restaurant, hired the people, bought the food, cooked it, and paid the bills. And then, they showed up in an old car and took 30% of the money. So yeah, but the industry's kind of pushing back. So there is some shift in that. We have we switched over to a point of sale system called Toast, and Toast kind of did this contract with one of the delivery companies, which was a lot more favorable for us. So, right. And we do charge the customer for that. If you want that burger to show up at your door, you want the comfort of that, you are going to pay an extra, you know, $7-$8 for it. But you get to make that choice, and then we get to make a good decision, business decision on that. So
Bonnie, despite all the negatives that we just talked about with regard to these delivery services, I mean, you were not exactly offering inexpensive food. You were fine dining, and the food was priced accordingly, and you have a clientele who obviously could afford that. So was that not a good option for you to keep Carpe Diem open?
You know, fine dining is hard to deliver in a box. A lot of food it will become overcooked or dry. I mean, if you ordered a filet to go and you ordered it medium rare, by the time you got it to your house, it's going to probably be more medium. It's a hard food to deliver. So we would have ended up bringing our menu, to being more casual and having sauces on it and things to keep it moist. So, you know, we would have had to transition our menu. Right. Significantly, which is why we kind of merged those types of things on our menu with the menu at Earl's. So we're doing takeout at Earl's with some of the Carpe Diem dishes.
Now Jackie DeLoach, who owns Hattie's Tap and Tavern, is one of those bar owners that has had the door closed now for 5 months, but she's still hanging in there. And I'm told that you've switched from selling drinks to selling hoodies and shirts. Is that... That's a completely different business. You become a haberdasher. Is that working for you?
Yes, surprisingly, I have been printing merchandise and just selling it online, and it has been keeping us afloat, and it's been doing great. And we have a really great customer base, and they continue to support us, and that's what keeps us alive.
Wow. How did you get the word out to not just your customers, but to the world at large that suddenly Hattie's is selling sweatshirts and hoodies?
I've always had a great relationship with Mom and Pop's print shop, and I contacted them right away and said, I need to print a bunch of items. I don't know how long this is going to last. Let's make it happen. And my close friend Penny Mann decided to make a website within hours of finding out that we had to shut down. And we made it happen.
I have some more questions about how you and other bar owners may be staying afloat during this shutdown, and we'll ask those questions when we come back. We'll also talk more about the restaurant business and how it's being impacted and surviving this, and the help that has come or not from the government when we come back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. In Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE, I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about restaurants and bars and how they're faring in this pandemic. We're here with the Chef Greg Collier from Leah and Louise in Camp North End and The Yoke at 7th Street Market. Paul Manley is the owner of Sea Level Uptown, Waterman Fish Bar in South End, and Ace Number 3, a burger place in the Belmont neighborhood. Bonnie Warford owns Earl's Grocery on Elizabeth Avenue and former owner of Carpe Diem. And Jackie DeLoach is the owner of Hattie's Tap and Tavern in the Plaza Midwood area. Jackie, you've also had car washes to bring in money. You've participated in streaming events. You've become a drop-off location for the Black Lives Matter protesters. Except for the car washes, I don't think any of those involve any exchange of money. So how are you making money? How are you staying afloat? How are you paying the rent?
Other than our merchandise, I'm lucky that I saved. I like being able to be a big part of the community, and I'm not going to stop doing that. So through our blood drives and, you know, being a drop-off zone for the Black Lives Matter protests and being still very present in the community is really strong for us. But otherwise, we're floating by our customers, our regulars. They donate often and they don't forget about us, and we don't forget about them. And that's what keeps our heads up.
Jackie, that, if one of the things about your industry, you're part of our segment, is we all kind of have that favorite neighborhood tavern, pub, and place that we go to. And, you know, I think that there's a real danger of those places not making it. You know, you, Mike, you mentioned earlier about the craft beer, and craft beer is a very well organized piece, and they were able to get something happen immediately in their industry in order to be able to stay open and mm-hmm. have people in there. But, you know, the little corner pub places, there's, you know, the Jackies are out there doing it because they love to do it. And they like to provide this little place for people to go. And there's a real sensation there. And I think that, you know, it's a group that's, you know, that there's a big danger of those kind of places not being around. And I think, you know, Greg or Bonnie, we've never grabbed a beer before, but if we would, we would all have our favorite little place that we would go grab, a beer at. And that's the danger of Jackie. So good for you for, you know, hanging in there and being inventive and being part of that. But that's kind of that community piece of that little local neighborhood tavern part.
And like restaurants, some bars have already shut the doors permanently, particularly in the downtown area. Some people, long-standing bars, have shut their doors down there. The mayor was on this program yesterday, and she made reference to the fact that the city is trying to work with restaurants and other members of the hospitality industry, allowing them to be, shall we say, creative with the rules. They're allowing them to set up tables in parking lots and sidewalks and even spilling into the curb lane in some areas. I'm not sure how safe that is for diners, but nonetheless, they're trying to work with people and break the rules so that they can have more seating outdoors. And you mentioned, Bonnie, that part of the problem with Earl's was that you had to take all the seating out indoors and replace them with grocery shelves. You're in Elizabeth with a decent sidewalk real estate. Is that not an option for you?
It was an option. I mean, we didn't have to take the seating out of Earl's, but we were trying to eliminate risk. And at that time, the phase two wasn't open, so people weren't eating inside anyway. We made the choice to transition Earl's to more of a grocery, you know, combining kind of both supply chains, because it's a model that we can operate the same way no matter what's going on with COVID. So whether we are just doing takeout or whether people can come in the store, we're going to have an online app soon where you can order groceries online and you can order takeout online. So if we combine those things, it didn't matter what was going on with COVID because we can operate the same way no matter what. Mm. So we were trying to look for a model that we could sustain.
You were on Sarah D'Elia's WFAE podcast, Social Distancing, and you told her that you've been doing well with curbside orders and were eventually able to open your doors to sit-down service at Leah and Louise. But your wife, Sabrina, describes Leah and Louise, at least she describes the original concept, as being juke joint chic. That sounds like a very nice party to me. You've been talking about this, that people are coming in. Have you realized the concept under these pandemic conditions?
Partially. Again, any restaurant owner who has some service and people are coming in and they're enjoying the food and they're enjoying the time and they're enjoying the space, in this pandemic, we're happy. Be clear, like, we do this because we love it. We're not going to get rich because we open a restaurant. So any little bit is super, super happy and we're elated about it. But we haven't been able to party necessarily, but we feel like each guest and each table has the opportunity to party. Like juke joints are, we were trying to figure out what a bistro was in the American South for Black folks, you know, back in the day. So juke joints are what kind of that. And really, juke joints are just about good bourbon, good whiskey, and good blues music. So we got blues music playing. Justin Hazelton is our bar manager. He does a wonderful bourbon and whiskey cocktail. So we kind of have an individual party for every table. So we ain't going crazy yet, but we're doing a little bit.
What your wife points out, that this particular juke joint chic means there's no leaky windows and no leaky walls. So
absolutely no leaky windows, no leaky walls, and no bootlegging of any kind.
So Jackie, you run a bar. Alcohol sales is where you make all of your money under normal circumstances, and right now you can't sell any. Why wouldn't it be possible for bars to refashion themselves in a similar fashion to what the brew pubs are doing so that you too can open? What would be required there? Would it be just, you getting permission, here's what we're doing now, and getting permission from the city, or do you have to go through the ABC board because you're a bar?
Well, that's our biggest issue right now, is because we have to go, you know, and follow the mandates and the rules. But if we were to open, we're prepared. We have set up several benches on our back patio. And, you know, I'm happy to not have people sit at our actual bar. I will make placement and seating elsewhere and have extra staff. I'll be here every day to make sure we're cleaning after people. And the only difference is we're not having a food service. But we're not able to get that opportunity. But we want to be able to provide for our customers.
I mentioned earlier that 1 in 9 people are employed in the hospitality industry. I'm just curious of how many people collectively amongst all of you have been impacted by this. Clearly, you lost your chef, Bonnie, which is why one reason why you closed Carpe Diem. Some of the employees have dropped away. How many of you are keeping people on staff? Have you been helped by PPP in any way? And have the staff members that are no longer working been able to get access to the money they need to survive? Because a lot of people have reported that despite the fact that the money has been made available allegedly by the government, they're not getting it. What's been your experience? I'm not sure who wants to go first on that.
I'll go. We when the PPP initially came out, we went to our bank and we were with a big bank. We were with Wells, and like a lot of other small businesses, it just did not go well trying to file for PPP through that. We found another bank. We got it in the second wave, and we did get some funding, depending on the need for each of the restaurants, and. You know, our experience was because it was such a moving target, and every day there was a different rule and it was different ways of spending it, and kind of the, you know, how it was going to be forgiven was really kind of a moving target. We just did the best we could every day and spent the money on the intention of it, which was employing people and paying rent and paying your utilities. So we still using that money today at sea level. We still subsidize the staff because of the fact that we have a really great wait staff and bartenders, but they're not, but the mid business isn't there as yet. So we're still using that money to do that. So once that runs out, you know, that's a different story.
Everybody's concerned about being healthy. Business owners are concerned about it. The employees, the frontline workers, the people who interact with the customers worry about it. The customers worry about being safe. And Paul, I know that you had to close one of your restaurants at least temporarily because one of your employees tested positive. What did you learn from that experience?
Well, as I said, it was just, you know, the whole thing kind of changed each day. And the one thing, our takeaway was we had a health check-in that we felt like was pretty vigorous, but we had a language barrier. So English is a second language. So the person that was positive, they went to get tested and they came to work, and that was the issue that we had, that we didn't realize that she should be at home pending a test result. And so then we did this whole metrics of who had direct contact with this person. And we made this decided it was best to close for several days in order for that, that stay at home time to pass through there. So we upped our game as far as the health check-in. We took the language barrier more seriously at that point and changed that piece and just went from there. So we're always putting people in quarantine if they got their roommate or somebody's positive or they visited a family member or whatnot. And so we kind of, you know, at Waterman, it's fairly busy. We have a little bit more staff than we need just because we're, you know, we have to have the ability and flexibility to rotate people in and out as needed.
Jackie, you were also on Sarah D'Elia's podcast, Social Distancing, talking about your predicament of having to close and having been closed for months now. And you're pretty angry at those people who aren't wearing masks. And you've seen on television, I guess, and maybe even personal experience, crowded restaurants. And you say it hurts your feelings. That's a quote. It hurts your feelings. And you said that people going out without wearing masks is like them sticking their middle finger up to you. Do you understand the resistance that people have to wearing masks?
It's difficult because, you know, we all have had to adapt. Since March, every single one of us has had to change our daily lives and our businesses to be able to move forward and to sustain. And, you know, the people that are deciding that, you know, they don't need to wear a mask, they are the problem. They are the reason why we will continue to have to adapt so much, and why businesses like myself will have to remain closed until, you know, that makes a change. And then we can all move forward and try to, in quotes, somewhat go back to normal. But it's up to us. It's not up to one single person. It's up to all of us.
The message from all the health experts is that masks are the only line of defense that we really have at the moment, and therefore the best line of defense that we really have, and that because people aren't wearing them and aren't social distancing properly, that they are keeping the economy closed. Do you think that's a message that hasn't effectively gotten out, that it's not just your right to not wear the mask, but it's that you are slowing down the recovery?
Cool.
Jackie?
Yes. Sure. I mean, until we realize. Yeah.
So, Bonnie, when you come to a restaurant, you have to take your mask off to eat. And I think everybody's dealing with that right now. But there have been some retailers who, although they are telling you on the door, don't come in without a mask, they are not enforcing that at all. And the government seems loath to make anybody enforce that. What do you do at Earl's Grocery? Because you don't need to take your mask off in a grocery store.
We've been requiring masks since the day we opened, even prior to the mandate, because we really feel strongly about protecting our staff and protecting our customers. And so many people are scared to go to the major grocery stores, and that's one place where we feel like we can offer that safety, because we're requiring it, and that's what we want to instill. So we want people to come there and feel like they've made a good choice.
Have you gotten any resistance to that?
A few times, but we, if they don't have a mask with them, which most people have a mask at this point, we just give them a mask. But yeah, we've definitely gotten resistance, but we're sticking to it. Even if they remove the mandate, until COVID's over, this is the way we're going.
So when you go to Leah and Louise's website, Greg, aside from the message asking people to support restaurants in general, not just your own, during this crisis, you say, you ask guests to, this is a quote, to have masks while in the restaurant. So have people been cooperative? They have to take them off to eat and drink, obviously, but while they're waiting for the food, you're asking them to wear masks. Are people cooperating with that?
So we Camp Northam provided door signs for everybody that says, please wear a mask. They're really, like, really cute signs done by Good Posted. So when people hit the door, if they don't have mask on, we ask them to put a mask on. If somebody gets up and they start walking towards the bathroom, our hostess kind of goes and says, hey, could you put a mask on real quick? Mm-hmm. And sometimes people drop a mask, the mask gets wet or whatever, because you might have a paper mask. We provide masks as well, because the goal is for everybody to get out of this safely, not for you to be able to say, well, I don't want to wear my mask. I shouldn't have to wear my mask. We're just trying to have everybody safe.
So Twyla on Facebook says, we just closed Carolina Vines Wine Bar and Wine Shop in Newton. We are playing by the rules, but our customers are not coming out, or they're going to pseudo restaurants that are not complying to mask and physical distancing requirements. That's probably part of the problem. So what can restaurant goers and people who frequent bars do to help you out very quickly, Paul?
Follow the rules and support your local businesses. I think that would be my biggest request. And if you are venturing out, venture out of town too. There's a lot of great places down there too.
Do you think this will recover? Once the pandemic is over, do you think we'll have the restaurant scene we had before?
No.
No. Wow. Paul Manley, owner of Sea Level, Waterman Fish Bar, Ace Number 3, Greg Collier, a James Beard Award nominee and owner of Leah and Louise and the Yoke, Bonnie Warford, owner of Earl's Grocery, and Jackie Deloach, owner of Hattie's Tap and Tavern. Buy her sweatshirts. Do it now. Thank you all for the hour. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.